It's the Burt Cohen Show. America we have all known and loved is under grave threat. I'm not exaggerating at all. And it's not from any outside terrorist organization. For the first time in our history, the military has granted itself the authority to quell a civil disturbance. On May 2013, the military quietly gave itself the ability to police the streets of America without obtaining prior local or state consent, upending a precedent that has been placed for more than two centuries of civilian control of the military. Our guest today argues that these new and some would say startling official regulatory changes issued unilaterally from the Department of Defense are a real historic game changer. We were all relieved, of course, that the two men responsible for the Boston Marathon bombing were caught as quickly as they were. But a great many Americans were shaken up, but we saw on the streets of one of America's largest cities, it sure looked to me like a police state. The birthplace of the rebellion against British tyranny was suddenly transformed into a locked down, militarily commanded occupied city. Civil libertarians saw a scene chilling in the extreme. Our guest today is Jed Morey, president of Morey Publishing, LLC, a socially responsible media company. Morey is publisher of the Long Island Press, which is Long Island's cultural and investigative news journal, which enjoys a circulation of 100,000. And he recently wrote a widely published article about the military quietly granting itself the power to police our streets without local or state consent. Jed, are you there?
I am here.
Oh, good. Well, I gave the introduction. Could you tell us about what happened recently regarding the militarization of domestic law enforcement? What happened? And there's so many questions about it, and it's just it's really hard to believe.
Sure. My publication is the Long Island Press, and we have done a fair amount of work on covering the National Defense Authorization Act, which there's a lawsuit that is an appeals court between Chris Hedges, who's a journalist, and a number of other plaintiffs, and the administration, basically claiming that they had gone too far with the AUMF, the Authorization for Use of Military Force. The issue with the NDAA was that there's a presumption in the language that was put into this indefinite detention clause 2 years ago that the military might be able to supersede civilian authority and encroach upon First Amendment rights of journalists and advocates and anybody who might organize a protest. So that, while they're battling that on the one front, we came across a lead that the Department of Defense had taken a sort of a sub-legislative move by, instead of going through Congress, going directly to the U.S. Code, and they changed some language in some old code, which is not unusual to update language in the code, but the addition of certain language was shocking, to say the least, in that the Department of Defense essentially authorized themselves to take control of various situations that had previously been fairly well defined, so they recodified those expectations. and then added in something related to civil disturbances that basically said, in the event that the president is impossible to communicate with, the military may, within its own discretion, take matters essentially into their own hands, quote, temporarily, and quell a civil disturbance.
Wow, there's so many vagaries there. Now, I wonder, my first question is, how long would the president have to be unable to be reach on a telephone? I mean, would it be, if they couldn't reach him at a certain time, does that mean that it has to be done? I mean, that's pretty pretty vague, certainly.
Well, yeah, what's funny about that, Bert, is that not only does it not define how and what circumstances the president might be impossible to obtain, but it also ignores the statutory protocol for the chain of command, which we already have that in place, the vice president, of course. And,
right.
You know, there's probably about 9 other people that you can think of that would be fairly obtainable. So, I mean, it's wrong on so many different levels.
So many.
Ignoring the statutory protocol. But when I interviewed the Pentagon on this matter, you know, and basically asked them, well, what defines temporary and and how do you define impossible to get the president's authorization?
Right.
They pointed to a little bit of precedent. They said in 1906 there was a natural disaster in California and the federal troops were marshaled to protect a U.S. mint in California. So this was their basis for, I guess, trying to foresee some sort of problem where the president might not be attainable. Of course, our communication systems, I believe, are a little bit more advanced than they were in 1906.
Yeah.
The whole thing strains credulity and is essentially a wanton power grab, which is how the constitutional law professors that I interviewed for the story basically put it, and they said this is unprecedented in its scope in terms of a power grab.
Wow. If you just tuned in, our guest today on the Bert Cohen Show is Jed Maury, who's president of Maury Publishing and publisher of Long Island Press, and kind of broke the story on this just unfathomable power grab. Who, any clue as to what interest made this happen? Where did this this power grab come from? What's the source of it?
You know, my, and this would only be a guess, but
right.
we've seen such an erosion, a very gradual but significant erosion of civil liberties over the past decade.
No, for sure.
And there, I think behind the scenes, there's a great amount of posturing between the agencies that are vying for this type of military control. You know, on one hand, you have the FBI that is supposed to be able to exert domestic police authority on federal cases, but then you have certain instances here where you have the Pentagon saying, well, we'd like to have the ability to do it in the case of CBNRE events, which should be chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, or improvised explosive devices. And the FBI pushes back on that, and then, of course, you have the CIA that says, well, the globe is our purview, and we'll carry out missions as we see fit. And I believe there's a tremendous amount of consternation with the president's forces in JSOC and the operations that they've carried out abroad.
What's JSOC?
JSOC is essentially the elite force that is under the exclusive purview of the president that carries out many of our missions abroad. And they have run into the CIA in this jurisdiction battle for, whose job is this really to carry out what can only be considered assassinations in countries that are deemed to be harboring terrorists. I mean, it's very murky right now.
Yeah.
What makes it even murkier is that they seem to be wanting to import much of this skill set in order to marshal resources domestically. And, you know, I began the piece by saying that it would be difficult for anybody who was watching the Boston bombing case unfold on television.
Right.
It'd be difficult for any layperson to discern between the military and the local police authorities.
Absolutely.
Because our police now are fully militarized.
Yes.
And so it begs the question as to what event could be so outrageous that you can't get the president on the phone. The chain of command is deemed irrelevant after that. The local authorities, it's beyond their capabilities, which are military at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And why on earth would you need that? What civil, quote, civil disturbance, which is undefined, would be that significant that you would have to call in federal troops? And this is not the National Guard, mind you.
Well, the National Guard has been sort of deputized in certain situations. We'll go back to May 4th, 1970, to see the incredibly tragic results there at Kent State when four unarmed students were murdered. There's more and more evidence that there was actually an order given to fire into the crowd. And I wonder if... I mean, it sounds pretty extreme to suggest that this new law, these new rules, again, it wasn't made, you know, the change wasn't made by law, it was made by rules change. Could the Kent State massacre be considered legal under this new situation?
Oh, without a doubt, because the parameters, again, are so vague as they define it, that I'll give you one example that they... It's not just the granting of authority, but to whom it's granted. On the ground, under this rule, a local military commander, and again, in my interview with the Pentagon, commander is defined as somebody who has been trained to be in a position of command.
Yeah.
Which, again, it strains all credulity.
Goodness.
But this person can... So if this person theoretically does not have access to the president, which is reasonable to assume that not everybody has a direct line to the president,
true,
that they can, he or she can take matters into their own hands and quell a disturbance, quote, temporarily. And I think a bigger issue here is that there is no definition of temporary.
Right.
And the military, as we've seen in Guantanamo, isn't all that great at defining it for us either.
And what's a disturbance? What constitutes a disturbance? I mean, could it be people holding up signs peacefully saying, you know, we don't support this or that war? Is disturbance clearly defined under these rules?
You know, it's interesting. We'd been listening to the arguments in the appellate court for the NDAA. And Bruce Afrin, who's one of the attorneys for the plaintiffs, had said to the justices, you know, if we were here today and outside in Foley Square, there was a Muslim American man holding a sign that said "Death to America," his speech would be theoretically protected under the First Amendment. But if 10,000 men were outside holding signs that said "Death to America," and they were of Muslim origin, would that be a disturbance? How far are we going to go in defining what qualifies and what constitutes protected speech?
Right.
And this is that slippery slope that the government refuses to define. And in this attempt, I think it's troubling because it's even another end run around the legislature. And my guess is we'll see this repealed. I mean, I can't imagine this language standing, to be honest, because I think the legislature will take great offense to the fact that this was done in an extrajudicial and sub-legislative fashion.
Well, there are egos involved, which usually means trouble, but in this case, maybe not. People don't like their turf encroached on. And, you know, you talk about what defines a commander, there could be a great deal of disagreement as to who's in charge, who is the commander. You know, and there's all different branches of the military. There's local and state police. I mean, who is the commander here? And it could get pretty darn messy. And so how did... You know, I find it amazing that this hasn't made bigger news, and it seems like it was intentionally this military power grab was done very, very quietly. How did you find out about it?
Well, it's interesting because the rule itself was changed. There was an attempt to change the language in the rule it was a couple of years ago. And the way rule changes occur is that they will put the language in for public comment. The public has 60 days to comment on it, and then it will go through the process of coordinating this with other rules that might also be affected, pull them all together, and then update the code. And so this is done every day. This is what the folks at the Federal Register do, and those who update the code and get rid of old code that no longer applies. So this is a fairly routine process.
Okay.
What's disturbing is that there were two public comments that were registered, and both of the comments were challenged all of the things that we challenged in the article, which is to say that civil disturbance is too vague. This upends posse comitatus. It runs afoul of the Insurrection Act. This runs afoul of 200 years of precedent. This isn't how we do things in America. Why isn't this being done legislatively? And all these things were raised in the public comment section. Now, at that point, the author has the obligation to then respond and to hopefully then alter the language according to what the comments say.
Mm-hmm.
And in both instances, on both comments, which were virtually identical, their response was no action required. So they unilaterally alter the language, put it out for public comment, unilaterally ignore the public comments, and then put it in to update in the register. And I think the reason that we got a hold of this information is there were some activists at a protest that we were covering that were following this and had downloaded it from the government printing office, and they handed it to us at the protest and said, "You guys have done great work on the NDAA. You'll get what this means." And, you know, to be honest, Bert, I took it back and I took it home with me for about a week, and I read it, I don't know, 20 times in just trying to challenge myself and say, could this be possible?
Right.
Cross-referenced it and downloaded it myself from the printing office, and finally started reaching out to some people I respect, these constitutional law professors, and the interviews were funny because it was sort of like, okay, so what are we taking a look at? And I'd send them the link to the register,
mm-hmm.
and they'd get back to me and say, how did you find this? What just happened here? Why is nobody talking about this? So called the Department of Defense, found a spokesperson willing to speak to us, and they acknowledged, well, yeah, there are things that we need to do and we need to take control of, and this absolutely makes sense, and it's nothing out of tradition, nothing out of the ordinary, and you know, we'll exercise prudence in every scenario.
Oh, trust them.
Okay. Well, then I guess that's that. I mean, even though it has not yet hit our colleagues in the mainstream media,
right? Which is curious.
The article itself did somewhat catch fire.
Yes,
and had a tremendous amount of viewers, and you know, a lot of comments as well. We also pressured Senator Leahy's office,
uh-huh.
because 2 years ago there was language very, very similar to this that was inserted to the National Defense Authorization Act. I forget which year it was offhand. And they let it go because, you know, these are big omnibus bills that just have to organize spending for the year. They let it go, and then the very next year, Senator Leahy gathered enough support to specifically repeal this almost identical language from the NDAA and said, you know, this upends, again, posse comitatus, this upends the Insurrection Act, and, you know, hundreds of years of precedent, and this is dangerous territory for the military to get into. And I think his term was, there's a useful friction that exists between insurrection and posse comitatus, and this strips it away. We need to put it back in place to give the American people the comfort that they need.
And I think at this point, it is rather important to define posse comitatus. And NDAA is the, what, National Defense Authorization Act? Is that NDAA?
Yes, sir. So the NDAA is the essentially the organization of defense spending.
Sure.
So it's not a spending bill, but it's an organizational bill, and it basically organizes all the resources, and it changes some of the rules with respect to how we employ these resources. And it's updated every year on New Year's Eve, and usually goes through with flying colors.
Mm-hmm.
It's only in the last few years that we've seen these very bizarre attempts to update certain language with these encroachments on our civil liberties. A couple of years ago, in the 2011 NDAA, John McCain, and this I find this very bizarre, and this is the root of the Hedges versus Obama case, John McCain authored a provision that's known as the indefinite detention provision, authored it so that the, again, giving the government very vague and nebulous authority over detaining U.S. citizens. Where, we don't know. Could it be domestically? We're not sure.
Mm.
For how long? Doesn't say.
Mm.
And this is where there were some people that were able to demonstrate standing in the case, journalists and activists together, along with Daniel Ellsberg of the Pentagon Papers, Noam Chomsky, who's a known activist as well. They were all able to demonstrate standing and say, wait a minute, this chills speech because you won't define exactly what circumstances would authorize you to detain us. You also don't say for how long. And why is the military performing any of these type of operations domestically? And the government's response was, well, have we done it yet that you know of? In that case, you can trust us. And that's literally the defense. I mean, we listened to it in appeals court as well, and it's stunning. And they, the government lost handily in the first first district court.
Well, that's reassuring.
It's reassuring, and we hope that the appellate division shares the same wisdom. They're not, but then what happens from there, of course,
right,
is anybody's guess, because the Supreme Court would be the next step, and there's no telling whether or not they would take the case on.
Wow, with this particular Supreme Court, whether they take the case and what they would say about it, because, from this layperson's understanding of the Constitution, it does seem that this particular Supreme Court has done some, shall we say, creative ruling when it comes to the Constitution. And if you just tuned in to the Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Jed Mori. We're talking about a rather amazing, stunning rule change that allows the military to kind of take control of law enforcement in these currently United States. And I do need to, we've talked a couple times about the Insurrection Act and the Posse Comitatus. The Insurrection Act was in 1807, and then the Posse Comitatus Act came in during Reconstruction back in 1878. What can you tell us about those two particular acts and how they might relate to this rather stunning rule change?
Sure. Well, again, to paraphrase Senator Leahy, who said that that a useful friction existed between the two acts in order to provide some comfort for civilians, that the military would never take things too far domestically. The Insurrection Act essentially said that the president, under very limited circumstances, can deputize the National Guard, can deputize forces in order to assist but not take over for civilian duties, civilian law enforcement duties. And that is really what established the protocol of operations with the National Guard. Now, the National Guard, these are federally trained troops that can be deputized for a state. They're stationed all over the nation, obviously.
And the initiative, pardon me for interrupting, but the initiative has to come from local law enforcement, either the local or the state, right? I mean, the National Guard has to be asked. They can't initiate it on their own, correct?
That's absolutely correct. There, the one time that comes to mind that there was some confusion was when Governor Wallace had requested the use of the National Guard in order to prevent the children from the young black children from going to school during desegregation.
Right.
At which point, the president at the time, wily one that he was, took that and ran with it and said, "Sure, you can call them up, but then because you placed the order to call them up, I'm going to deputize them as federal troops with a different mission."
Yeah.
Which was, I mean, it's obviously fascinating to read that. Only somebody that was as adept at manipulating the rules as LBJ would have been able to come up with that scenario. And it's the only time I can think of where a governor and then a president had different missions and used one another in order to employ these resources. But for the most part, you're absolutely correct in that the local governor will request the use of the troops. It's granted then through the president and through executive authority, and then he can marshal them as he sees fit, but not to take over for domestic operations,
right?
Which essentially means that they do not have the authority to arrest. They don't have the authority to do anything that the police might do except to go in and stabilize and secure a situation, whether it's a natural disaster, as we saw with Katrina, whether it's perhaps an IED device. Like in the very beginning of the Boston manhunt, you might remember that there was a question as to whether or not they would invoke the National Guard in order to lock down several other areas because they didn't know if it was part of a coordinated attack.
Right.
As it turns out, the domestic law enforcement agencies had everything fairly well under control, had coordinated with the FBI to for intelligence to understand that these young men were acting theoretically alone and it wasn't needed. But it's always been a very touchy. There's been a great deal of reverence with respect to calling on even the National Guard because we've seen some things go very, very wrong. To your point, Kent State, 1973, with the reoccupation of Wounded Knee. You know, troops are trained to do very specific things. One of those things is to kill.
Right.
And that's what we always need to be wary of, and I think that's why that tension exists, and it is so useful. So what Posse Comitatus did, essentially, is it codified the behavior that was supposed to be fully implemented under the Insurrection Act by putting teeth into it, essentially saying that anyone that authorizes the military against our own citizens or domestically without the proper authority will actually have a sentence. There's a 2-year sentence, and they will be found guilty of a crime. That's anybody from, you know, a local commander all the way up to the president. So they work together because the Insurrection Act establishes the protocol. Posse Comitatus makes sure that there's teeth to it, and that's why this is so bizarre and undermining, is to go sublegislatively and upend all of this tradition and all of the reverence that we've had for making sure that we don't make any missteps with our own citizens. And so now, I think what has anybody interested in civil liberties, I think what has everybody on edge is that when you look at this steady erosion, when you look at the Patriot Act, you look at the AUMF.
AUMF, what's that?
The Authorization for Use of Military Force, okay. Which essentially granted President Bush the ability to go after al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
But even back then, the rules were very, very specific. We can go after al-Qaeda in the places that we know they organized and attacked us from, which is what led us to Afghanistan and then somewhat speciously into Iraq. But it was never intended to grant the executive branch authority to go and carry out missions in other places. So the AUMF is at the crux of the concern over the drone debate, for example. The president believes, and the administration believes, that they have the authorization to carry out these activities and strikes in places where terrorists may reside. But the AUMF does not call for that. The NDAA tried to expand that. The FISA amendment of 2008, which is essentially legalizing federal wiretapping, mm-hmm. without warrantless wiretapping.
Right.
And now you get into this provision that, again, happens in sort of another sphere. And then you have all the infighting with the agencies as to who's in control, who has all of the information, and who's supposed to do what with it.
Right.
And, you know, we have some hackers, some hacktivists that are being held indefinitely now. Know of two communication management units, as they call them, that were illegally organized and authorized under the Bush administration to hold and detain dual nationals in our nation, in our country. So we have all of these little pockets that all stem back to fighting the, quote, war on terror. And I think the greater fear is that we're beginning now to import these tools, these devices that we have, that were supposed to be carried out abroad, and now we're importing them and you know, bringing them for domestic use. And that's, I think, what is so severely troubling about all of these rule changes.
Yes, indeed. That is very troubling. And at least, you know, a lot of people have great concerns about the use of drones, the extrajudicial executions. But compared to what we're talking about now, though, that drone parameter, the rules are very specific, whereas what we're talking about here, this new rule that has been changed, is just filled with lots and lots of vagaries. And I'm guessing they're intentionally vague. And I wonder if you, Jed, could specify some of the vague language of the new rules which might concern traditional, you know, conservative Americans, people who believe in, oh, that old thing, the Constitution.
Sure. Well, the I think the passage that gives people the most trouble here is it's just a few sentences, and I'll read it to you. Federal military commanders have the authority, in extraordinary emergency circumstances where prior authorization by the president is impossible and duly constituted local authorities are unable to control the situation, to engage temporarily in activities necessary to quell large-scale, unexpected civil disturbances.
Wow.
If you are an Occupy, so, you know, our brief history in this is that we covered Occupy Wall Street very closely because we're in a neighboring municipality.
Right.
So we covered that extensively, and that's how we grew to learn so much about the NDAA and what was transpiring in the courts. And it all does make for fascinating reporting and fascinating reading, but it is also chilling when you see that the government's defense in each of these cases, for example, when they cleared out Zuccotti Park in right. the middle of the night,
mm-hmm.
that was illegal. That was unconstitutional. But there was no one to hold them accountable for doing it.
Right.
Nobody came back. And as much as we organized and as much as we protested that, and as much as we wrote that this was a foul of the Constitution, it happened, nobody was punished, and everyone got away with it.
And the thing you read about the language, that specific language, as someone who worked in making laws, you know, in the legislature of my state, you know, bells went off about 10 times there with
sure.
the language, which is just amazingly vague and open to such huge interpretation. And my guess is the intention was there to be vague.
Well, Bert, when I asked the Pentagon spokesperson what would qualify, there was obviously no real response, except to some. He gave me a hypothetical situation, keeping it close to home for me. He said that Fort Hamilton in Brooklyn, for example, if there was a mint or if the Federal Reserve was under attack and Fort Hamilton in Brooklyn could be marshaled without getting in touch with the president in order to lock that down and control the situation and then hand it over, that might qualify, which also, again, is rather strange considering the overwhelming firepower that the NYPD possesses. I think that the NYPD might have a problem with that example. And I know for sure that the mayor would have a problem with that.
Yeah.
But when I asked him about Occupy, he took his time in answering the question and essentially said that there were several times during the Occupy season, as it were, that laws were broken, and he could see that that there were Americans that were performing illegal acts, and that there are instances that might be close to what they're describing, but nothing got there.
What do you mean nothing got there?
Nothing got quite to the point where they felt the need to act,
even
had this provision been fully enforced at the time. But it does... I find it very, very chilling, having been so close to Occupy, and you know, I wasn't in Oakland, but certainly viewing what happened there,
right.
there's no question in my mind that you know, the protesters in Oakland might have you know, triggered this, or at least the thought of going in and engaging the military as opposed to just domestic law enforcement. So these are I believe that Occupy was more troubling to the, you know, I hate to use such conspiracy words, but to the, quote, establishment, because it was so organic, and it was so widespread, and it happened in every city, and it was able to tap into a frustration that many people weren't able to articulate necessarily. And once it happened and it was widespread, people said, you know, oh, my God, somebody feels the same way I do.
Right.
And what's interesting about the next steps of this, Bert, I will tell you, is that the courts, and this is what makes it so fascinating, the courts have been very wary of militarization. And it's just as I could see the courts actually ruling against the military in anything that does come up, whether it's NDAA or if a suit ever comes of this, because there is a conservative streak that runs through the courts that does not like to see the military trampling on civilian jurisdiction. And in many cases, the conservative courts have been more friendly to these types of causes. So in our country now, we're seeing extremely progressive elements totally aligned with the most radical conservative elements of our nation with respect to civil liberties. And I think that's hard for people to wrap their minds around.
Mm. Well, and certainly, I mean, the term conservative contains the word conserve. You want to conserve something. And, you know, a genuine rock-ribbed conservative would, of course, forcefully defend the Constitution. What
right.
could be of higher value? What could be more worthy of conserving than the Constitution? So you're right. Here's a situation where, you know, traditional left and not so much the radical right, the right that is, pardon me, taken over the Republican Party, but genuine conservatives. And quite frankly, it makes me think of some people that the left might refer to as some of the gun nuts, for example. They fear their government taking over. And, you know, I think realistically, if one were to look at the power, the firepower of the military versus the firepower of even a heavily armed citizenry, well, guess which side wins. But, you know, this could, I would think, tap into a lot of the fears and kind of justify some of the fears that the gun lobby has about, you know, fighting against tyranny. I mean, what we're looking at here, what we're talking about here, I mean, if this is not a potential tyranny, I don't know what might be. And, you know, again, it's sort of, I hear myself saying these things, and it's a little bit hard to think, no, come on, I'm exaggerating here, but, you know, we're talking about here a kind of a military coup in a lot of ways. Am I exaggerating here? Am I, you know, fantasizing?
No, this is the language of military coup. I don't believe it will stand.
Right.
I mean, I know that the Department of Defense was already called in to explain themselves, that, you know, when we were tipping off legislators to the fact that this existed, it was news to them, which is, it shouldn't be news to them, but it was.
To whom again?
To the legislator.
Uh-huh, right.
To the legislative branch. And, it, you know, I agree with you that this language, there's a disbelief
right.
that this can exist, and you don't even want to say it out loud for fear that you do sound crazy, but this is the language of coup, and this is why we have layers and protections against this type of this activity. But I, you know, the progressive end of the nation, I think, is finally beginning to realize that the Obama administration, in many cases, with respect to war, regardless of the withdrawal, with respect to war, militarization, mm-hmm. fighting abroad, the war on terror, continuing the war on drugs, mass incarceration, on all of these progressive civil liberty items, that the Obama administration is very much just an extension of the Bush administration. And there's great disappointment there.
Oh, yeah.
And on the far right, there's the sharing of the disappointment, but with much more animosity towards the administration for its progressive actions that it has taken with health care. So The administration is not really doing itself much of a service with either its base or the people that are never going to like it. And I, quite frankly, can't figure out where the administration's coming from. I mean, you said something before about there at least being some sort of clear path with drone strikes. And I'm not sure I see that. I keep listening for listening to the language very closely, and I still don't hear it. I still don't understand. There's been no explanation as to why, for example, we would have gone after Al Awlaki's 16-year-old son a week after the strike, when clearly he was not an imminent threat. This is a U.S. citizen separated from the original drone strike incident, that was underage and had absolutely nothing to do, was not a terror threat, and was not part of his father's world, and we assassinated him. Well, the parameters that allowed us to do that, theoretically under NDAA and under this rule change, exist domestically. And that should give everybody pause, and we should all look at the administration and say, we're not buying it. Can you release the prisoners in Guantanamo? The answer is today.
Yes.
And under the same unconstitutional executive authority that they were detained in the first place.
And that's clearly one thing that has always differentiated the United States from other countries, from tyrannies, that we have a rule of law, not the rule of the dictator. I mean, we've had, you know, Pinochet in Chile and many, many examples of people where, you know, the military commander made the laws and made the rules. And certainly there's a lot of disturbing aspects to the drone strikes. They do seem to be extrajudicial assassinations and killing. What about, and you mentioned the war on drugs, and I wonder about precedents for this. The decades-old war on drugs, is there some, you know, looking to that as precedent for the federalization of police, for taking up for the military, the centralized military being in command? Is that somehow a justification for this rules change?
It's, you know, it's such a great question, Bert, because on the one hand, you look at the situation of you look at the militarization of the local law enforcement agencies, and you say, what couldn't they handle? My God.
Oh, no. I mean,
and then you realize
that
well, the one, and so you say, what's the difference? If they have all military training and equipment, and they do, they have state-of-the-art training and equipment and the ability to deploy it. Just as a quick sidebar, when I made the connection with the spokesperson from the Pentagon, he said, "Well, sure. Well, we wanted to avoid the mistakes that were made at Waco, for example, where we loaned the equipment to the ATF and they blew it. Well, so now that you've fully transferred the technology and trained them to use the technology, we have many military operations inside each police department. The difference being, though, the police chief can be fired. The mayor of the municipality, the governor, all of these people in civilian authority at some point are accountable to the people. And you can't lock somebody up locally without due process. We do have great rules in this country that can be enforced, and with enough of an outcry, we can bring things to light. When the military comes in, there's no one to fire them. There's nobody to say whether they're right or they're wrong. They have secret courts. They have tribunals. They have the ability to temporarily detain people without informing their relatives, without habeas corpus at all. And that's the big difference here. And so I think that makes your question even better, because what's so troubling about it is trying to imagine a scenario where the military would say, even though they have the capability, we're still coming in. I mean, it's mind-bending.
And what about the precedent of the greatly revered President Abraham Lincoln, who during the war, which had questionable legality, quite frankly, but I suppose that's another issue, he gathered tremendous authority and power to himself. He arrested many anti-war protesters and clamped down rather severely on freedom of the press and restricted the right of habeas corpus, I suppose, similarly temporarily. I wonder if that was any kind of a precedent for, you know, if it was a similar militarist power grab.
There's an issue that will be, I'm sure, debated until the
forever.
End of this empire,
yeah.
As to how much authority, how much constitutionality there was in his authority.
So does that justify it somehow, I wonder? I mean, there was, you know, we were at war then, so mm-hmm. therefore he could take these extraordinary efforts. Now, that was President Lincoln rather than the military itself, so that's a significant difference. At least Lincoln was elected by one party to the war. So it is a bit different. And I wonder also about, well, I don't know if you want to talk more about that.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, Posse Comitatus was enacted exactly for that reason. As you know, there were still federal troops that were employed during Reconstruction to enforce voting procedures and to, you know, assist in local law enforcement as the South was rebuilding, and that was a tremendous insult to injury to the South, which is why Posse Comitatus was put in place to ensure that, you know, the Insurrection Act on the one hand laid out the rules of engagement for how executive authority could be employed locally, domestically rather, and then Posse Comitatus again gave it its teeth, saying that had Lincoln done it again, he would have found himself in violation of that and in jail.
Oh, good. Well, so we still have the Posse Comitatus law. Now, what about traditional defenders of civil liberties, the ACLU, the Center for Constitutional Rights? Where have they been on these massive threats to civil liberties?
They've been up front, fighting NDAA. They've been certainly up front with warrantless wiretapping. They had written something when these rules were – there was a committee that was formed a few years ago to examine these rules, the old code, and how they could bring it together in order to marshal resources for civil disturbances – more specifically, those CBNRE events that we spoke about. The ACLU was very actively engaged in saying to them, leave it alone. We have full capability, civilian capability, to basically take care of any situation that you might think of, so back off. There was another attempt which resulted in these rules being written to, again, codify what their understanding is of intervening in a domestic disturbance, a civil disturbance, rather. And the ACLU, I think, was caught a little off guard. When I spoke with them, they acknowledged it was a problem, but they were so wrapped up in Guantanamo that they took a pass this time. They don't have a statement yet that they want to release, but there's no question that those that fight for civil liberties will eventually circle the wagons and try to beat this back.
And I wonder where people on the right who are often associated with guns and the NRA and the need to defend themselves, I would think that they might join in the fight. I haven't seen anything from them as of lately with regard to this. And if you just tuned in, there are those who don't start from the very beginning. The Bert Cohen Show, our guest today is Jed Morey, who is a publisher of the Long Island Press, which I suppose location dictated your involvement in this, covering such things as the Occupy season, as it's now called. And talking about the rules change, which was done very quietly, and to give the military sudden new power over our domestic situation here. And, you know, one thinks about the various – during the Vietnam era, there were lots and lots of protest, millions of people taking the streets, speaking out, exercising our civil liberties. And, boy, I'll tell you, when you think of civil disturbances, It'd be so easy to see those protests as civil disturbances in which, under the new rules, perhaps they could be considered appropriate times for a military takeover of civilian authority to enforce the rules. That it's incredibly chilling. And what about surveillance? We now seem to exist in kind of a surveillance state. There's that whole questionable, the so-called Patriot Act, but now there are cameras everywhere, and it's, you know, been called a surveillance state. I wonder if those new tools that are out there could themselves be tools that could be rather threatening to our traditional civil liberties.
Well, I think when you look at those tools in conjunction with the prosecutorial overreach that we've seen thus far under this administration, with the cases of Aaron Swartz, for example, there's Jeremy Hammond. There's a number of great cases to be following right now with respect to how far the Justice Department will go in prosecuting people. Even WikiLeaks. I mean, you know, we could talk all day about WikiLeaks and the justification for it or against it. The fact of the matter is we are in a surveillance state. I think that war is over, and it has been effectively won by the government.
Hmm.
You look at the AP hacking scandal. You look at, most recently, James Rosen of Fox News, who is now may possibly be brought up on charges for his role in disseminating information from a source from South Korea. These are normal journalistic activities. These are normal activist activities. You look at the case of Bradley Manning,
right,
who released nothing that was above secret, nothing that was top secret. And
right.
I think that everything in totality that was released by Bradley Manning had enough of a declassification to include 4.2 million people had access to that information, I believe.
Hmm.
So nothing even close to what we saw, for example, with the Pentagon Papers. And there is no question with respect to the video that he released of the choppers in Baghdad that these were war crimes that were covered up by the government.
Right.
And still the government is arduously prosecuting this young man, and it doesn't matter how you feel about what he did or what have you. What matters is that they're going full force against him, and he may never see the light of day, but those that committed the war crimes are also not going to be brought to light. And these are very troubling developments. We've been so desensitized, I think, by the amount of information that is out there that we've actually forgotten the value of such information. And that's what makes it very precarious for great journalists. There's no question it's what makes that's what has given a chilling effect to some people that might otherwise have published some damning information. This administration has brought up more people on charges of espionage than every other administration combined.
Wow, and it does seem that he's getting away with it because, well, to some extent, he's perceived to be a liberal. It's hard to see where that comes from, but that's the perception. On the left, if Bush were doing these, would be a tremendous hue and cry. But Obama's doing it, and not that many people are paying attention to it, which I find incredibly shocking. And you know, the word needs to go out. That's one of the things that, frankly, Thomas Jefferson talked about, how we need a free press, and it's so important to have a press as a check on the excessive power of the government. We've seen lots of governments, lots of regimes where there is no free press, and we call those tyrannies. And to threaten the press like this, and to not have citizen whistleblowers, really changes the very identity of what America has been.
It does, and from the world's perspective, there are two great glaring sores that we have right now with respect to our reputation. One is Guantanamo, and the other is the rampant use of these drones.
Yes.
And all we're doing is encouraging other nations to behave in similar ways. And one of the funnier things that, it's funny, ha-ha,
right,
funny and ironic sense, I guess, is the Congress had just released I forget what the title of it was, but there was out of committee came a report instructing other nations on how to handle their inmates in a more humanitarian fashion. And it's just one of those things that makes you scratch your head and say, you know, we have the nations, we have the most, the greatest incarcerated population of any nation on the planet. Right. We're number one.
Right.
You know, by percentage-wise and in total figures, I mean, it just, it's absolutely incredible. We have 5% of the world's population and 20% of the world's incarcerated population. And this is something we have to take a look at. And other nations look at us and we are a brutish, totalitarian regime, especially if you live in an area that is unstable.
Wow!
And look at Yemen or Somalia, or in Pakistan, they're looking at us like we're nuts.
Yeah, again, extrajudicial execution. It's, you know, it doesn't help us become more secure. Never mind right or wrong. It's counterproductive to our own national security. Now, I know people listening to the show tend to take action. What can people do? Is there a specific rule change number to which you can refer listeners that they can press their members of Congress to do something about?
If anybody can contact their local congressperson, because I believe it's easier sometimes to agitate congresspeople than it is senators.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
They tend to be a little more responsive. And,
yes.
You know, amazingly, even, you know, the conservative ones, I think, are the ones that are going to act because, A, they have skin in the game to do anything that's counter to the Obama administration. I mean, it's terrible to say. We don't want to increase the partisanship that it already exists, but this is a serious issue. So if anybody contacted their local congressperson and said, I have a very big problem with this rule change, and you can, if you go to the longislandpress.com, you can see it on the homepage, or you can follow me at Jed Morey on Twitter, and I'll be sending out links to it after the show so that people can actually reference the specific rule change. But I thank you for saying it, because I do think people need to be involved and be galvanized over this issue.
Absolutely. As Americans, as patriots, above Democrat, Republican, we got to protect our Constitution. We have to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. Hey, isn't that what the military is supposed to do?
Sounds vaguely familiar.
Thank you so much. It's been very illuminating and troubling, all this military madness. Jed Morey, thank you so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Thanks for your time today. I appreciate it.
All right, and this is about some military madness. We can do something. Thank you for listening.